In this hour of the program, we'll be talking about Iran and the relationship between Iran and the United States. And our guest is Kenneth Pollack. He's director of research at the Sabin Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., where he is also a senior fellow in foreign policy studies. He's been following the politics of the Middle East for quite a long time. Let me tell you just a little bit about him. He served as director for national security studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Before that, was director for Persian Gulf Affairs on the National Security Council. That's between 1999 and 2001. Also before that, Director for Near East and South Asian Affairs on the National Security Council. He was Senior Research Professor at the National Defense University and was an Iran-Iraq military analyst for the CIA between 88 and 1995. He's the author of a new book, which is titled The Persian Puzzle, The Conflict Between Iran and America. It's published by Random House and is out now. And he's joining us from Washington, from the Brookings Institution. We want to thank them for setting up the connection on their end, and thank him also for being with us. As we talk in this hour of the program, of course, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of people calling in is that they're brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, callers are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So locally, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Pollack, hello.
Hello, David. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks. And yourself?
I'm doing well, thank you. Good. Thanks for having me.
Well, I appreciate you giving us some of your time. To begin, I guess there are these days a lot of people are talking about, because we have just passed the 25th anniversary of the beginning of the Iran hostage crisis. A lot of people are talking about that. And it's probably tempting to, as one tries to understand the strained relationship between Iran and the United States, to start there. And I think, as you would say, and a lot of other people would say, is in fact, you have to go back a little bit further. You have to go back to 1953 and to the involvement of the United States in a coup in Iran at that time. It's something that, and I fear that I probably mentioned this almost every time we talk about Iran, but it's something I think that Americans need to understand and keep in mind, because it's something that many Americans, that's a story many Americans don't know, and certainly Iranians know it. They haven't forgotten what happened in 53, and certainly it was in their minds in 1979 when the Iranian Revolution took place. So let's talk about what happened in 1953.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. You know, as you've kind of laid it out, most Americans see our problems with Iran as starting in 1979, and I think for most Americans, the 1979 hostage crisis came out of the blue. Why were these people suddenly taking this act of war against us? But of course, for Iranians, this was not the first step. This was simply the continuation of a long series of problems that they saw. And as you point out, 1953 is where it all starts for Iranians. At that point in time, you had in Iran a very popular prime minister named Mohammad Mossadegh, who had taken on the British, Iran's old colonial exploiters, by nationalizing Iran's oil industry, taking it away from the British company that ran it today is the British Petroleum, BP, still in existence. And this was wildly popular in Iran. And in truth, the Truman administration counseled the British to accept it, that this was important, that Mossadegh was a nationalist, and that we really needed to allow this to happen because it was good for Iran, and otherwise Iran might be prey to the Soviets. But when the Eisenhower administration came into office, they had a very different perspective. And in collusion with the British, they overthrew Mossadegh. Now, one of the important points to make that most Iranians overlook is the fact that Mossadegh had actually made himself much more unpopular by the time he was overthrown than widely acknowledged. He had actually alienated a lot of Iran's clergy, and therefore all the CIA really had to do was to give him one final push. But in Iranian memory, the CIA coup itself came out of the blue. Their legend is that Mohammad Mossadegh was this wildly popular democratic leader who the CIA didn't like because he was nationalizing Iran Iran's oil, and so we moved in there and we overthrew them. And the problem is that they are right in the basics. The Eisenhower administration was fearful of Mossadegh. They thought he was a communist. They thought he was going to turn Iran over to the Russians, none of which was true. And the CIA did overthrow Mossadegh, and it was an out-and-out coup, and it was the first one that the CIA mounted in the post-war world.
Following that, a reason for Iranian resentment of the United States also has to do with the perception that we were continuing to support the Shah. And there was a great deal of resentment in Iran about what the country was like when he was in power, how he and his circle lived, the kind of dislocations that were a result of his idea of modernization, the fact that he was very hard on people that he saw as religious fundamentalists generally was seen as a despot and opponent of democracy. And here it is, the United States was seen as his chief supporter. And there, I think you really put a lot of responsibility at the door of the Carter administration.
Well, I think the Carter administration, the Nixon administration, and to a certain extent the Johnson administration as well, all have a share of the blame in how we handled Iran during the period after the 1953 coup and the restoration of the Shah. It's important to keep in mind kind of the Iranian perspective. You know, for 100 years before the 1953 coup, Iran had been subject to the depredations of the British and the Russians, who had involved themselves deeply in Iranian affairs, had mucked around in every aspect of Iranian life. And as a result of that century of foreign interference, Iranians just came to assume that this was the norm. And so in 1953, when the U.S. put the Shah back on the throne, and we made it very clear that the Shah was going to be our ally, there was an assumption that the United States was continuing to run Iran through the Shah exactly the way the Russians and the British had done so during their era of domination over Iran. Of course, this wasn't actually the case. The U.S. was allied with the Shah. U.S. presidents did look to the Shah as their close ally, as their proxy in this vital region of the world, especially at a time when the U.S. was completely preoccupied with the Vietnam War and didn't really have the time or the resources to pay attention to the instability of the Persian Gulf. They really looked to the Shah to do it for them. But as a result of that, the Shah actually had a tremendous amount of leverage. And much of what he did in Iran, he did entirely on his own. Oftentimes, the United States recognized that what he was doing probably wasn't the best thing for Iran and Iranians. But the sin that the United States was most guilty of during this period was not active complicity in the Shah's behavior, but just outright neglect. We just didn't care. And honestly, most of the United States knew a lot of what the Shah was doing. They knew that the Shah was running a rather brutal police state, and no one over here cared. They knew that the Shah was, his regime was deeply corrupt, and a lot of Iran's oil wealth was simply going into the pockets of the Shah's courtiers. And again, we did nothing about it. And so by 1979, we were complicit in the sense of we had done nothing to stop all of these depredations on Iranian society, but we weren't guilty the way that Iranians came to believe it, which is that we were behind the Shah and we were in fact setting him up to do these various things.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting that just recently I talked with a journalist who's written a book just on the hostage crisis and how it is that it developed. And one of the things that he notes is that very quickly this event got out of hand, and that it took on a larger, greater, almost symbolic significance to people on both sides, in the sense that when the students originally plotted this thing and carried it out, they were interested in making a symbolic, sort of striking a symbolic blow against the United States, and had in mind something that might last about 72 hours, and that that what happened was this big upswell of public reaction in Iran to the hostage taking gave it this weight that very quickly got away from them. And then on the other side in the United States, that the United States couldn't be seen as being weak. There was a great public sort of upswell of support here in the United States for a very tough sort of line. And it seemed that very quickly both sides got wedged into positions that would be almost impossible to negotiate from. And that's perhaps why it is that it went dragged on for more than a year.
Yeah, there's no question about it. That is absolutely correct. Yeah, the problem is that by 1979, you had this tremendous emotional set of issues within Iran, all bound up with the Iranian relationship with the United States. Iranians had come to see the United States as the source of all of their problems. All of the problems that they associated with the Shah, all of the things that were going on as a result of the Shah's regime that they didn't like, they believed were ultimately the cause of the United States because they saw us as the power behind the throne. When the students took the embassy, it's pretty clear that what they thought they were doing was simply striking a blow, taking an act of revenge for 1953. And some of the students said it very clearly, that they wanted to show that they could lash out at us, and in particular at the place where the coup was originated. The U.S. embassy was the place where the coup was basically enacted in 1953. But very quickly, this one gesture got bound up in these enormous emotions which Iranians had been harboring for these 25 years beforehand, some of them fully justified because there were things that the United States had done to Iran, particularly the coup. But in other cases, aspects of the relationship that were to a great extent figments of the Iranian imagination, embellishments of things that the United States had done, or simply the Iranian perception of foreign interference in their internal affairs transposed from the British and Russians onto the United States. And it did get caught in this web, and it made it infinitely more difficult for anyone to resolve because it did get up in these emotional issues. And of course, these emotional issues then became critical internal political issues inside of Iran because the Ayatollah Khomeini was using these various emotional issues to try to gain control over the new revolutionary governments.
One of the things that's really that's frustrating when you look at the ups and downs of the relationship, say, since the hostage crisis and attempts with people on both sides to establish some kind of dialogue, is just in how many cases we seem to come close, we stretch the hand out and we don't quite touch, and then something comes along to disrupt the process. And it seems that almost sometimes for every step forward we take, we end up taking two steps back. Why is it you think that has happened again and again and again?
Well, I think you're right. This is an important phenomenon that we've seen over the last 25 years. I think it's hard to ascribe it to any particular set of causes, but the things that do loom largest, again, are these emotional issues on both sides and the connections that exist between the emotional issues and domestic political considerations. So, for instance, in Iran, again, the Iranian Revolution came to be about anti-Americanism to a great extent. That was one of Ayatollah Khomeini's goals. Again, he saw the United States as the source of all evil in the world. He believed that ultimately it was the United States that was the great oppressor of the Iranian people. And so he made the Iranian Revolution about the United States, and that was part of his legacy, and it has been a part of his legacy even after his death. And so today, when Iranians think about the revolution, anti-Americanism is deeply embedded in that. And as I suggested before, that's also become a critical element of Iranian internal politics. Today, you've got a regime that are the descendants of Ayatollah Khomeini, spiritual and political descendants of Ayatollah Khomeini, who are having increasingly greater difficulty holding on to power. Younger Iranians are very unhappy with the state of Iran, both in terms of economic issues, social issues, and political issues. And the regime is very loath to give up on all of these aspects of its ideology, which justify their continuation in power. And unfortunately, the anti-Americanism is a key element of that ideology, which is, of course, a source of their legitimacy. So you've continuously had Iranians step forward and say, we need a better relationship with the United States. And the pushback that you've gotten from people on the other side is effectively, how can we justify our continued rule, give on this critical issue that allowed us to take power, which was the enmity between Iran and the United States? Hmm. And to a lesser extent, you've got similar issues in the United States. Iran is regularly vilified, and not always without cause. The Iranians have done a lot of really egregious things to the United States over the years. It's very easy for an American congressman to stand up and blame an American president for being soft on Iran. And no American president wants to be seen as being soft on Iran because of the emotional issues on the American side. going back to the hostage crisis and Lebanon and everything that came after.
Well, that's just to follow up on that just for a moment. I think that that you would suggest or that people would suggest that actually perhaps a little earlier in the Bush administration that looked like there were indeed some possibilities, not on a high level, but there were some contacts going on. There was maybe some possibility for an improvement in this relationship. And then came the Axis of Evil speech. I mean, why is it at that point that the Bush administration in so deliberately, so provocatively challenged the Iranian government at a time when it looked like there might be at least some small possibility for an improvement in that relationship?
Honestly, I don't think that we know just yet. It will be a fascinating thing to look at when the histories are finally written. As best I can tell, and I did do quite a bit of digging, and I spoke to a number of people in the Bush administration about this. As best I can tell, the Iranians were, to a certain extent, roadkill. The president's speechwriters came up with the term Axis of Evil, which they really liked. And really what they wanted to do was they wanted to start to lay out the case for Iraq. That was really what the Axis of Evil was about. It was first about Iraq, also recognized that North Korea was there, so it was an easy one to try to group Iraq and North Korea together. The speechwriters came up with this term, Axis of Evil, and they felt for some reason that if it was an axis, there had to be more than two. There had to be three. And so they decided who was the third most evil country in the world after Iraq and North Korea. Why, it was Iran. And there was pushback within the Bush administration from some of the foreign policy experts saying, you know, gee, we don't think that Iran belongs in the same category as Iraq and North Korea. Yeah, Iran is involved in some very nasty stuff, and clearly they are opposed to our interests. But they're a very different country. They're more pragmatic than either North Korea or Iraq. They've got a real reform movement. Maybe we should take it out. And apparently President Bush said, no, I want Iran in there. I want to send a signal that Iran is basically in the same category as these other two states. And as you point out, this was a real shock for Iranians. Iranians had not been expecting this. There are a huge number of young Iranians who are very pro-American. I don't think most Americans are aware of this, but on September 11th, 2001, there were spontaneous candlelight vigils in Tehran and several dozen other Iranian cities in solidarity with the United States, the only place that that was true in the entire Muslim Middle East. There was also actually, as you point out, there were these behind closed doors contacts, very extensive tacit cooperation between the United States and Iran in Afghanistan, stuff that was critical to the invasion of Afghanistan, where the two countries worked very well together. And it was at a time when I think a lot of Iranians were assuming that we might be able to have some kind of a detente. And then all of a sudden they get hit with the Axis of Evil speech. And to them, it seemed to come out of the blue.
Let me introduce again our guest. We have a caller. Would welcome others. Our guest is Ken Pollack. He is Director of Research at the Sabin Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. From 1995 until 96, and again between 99 and 2001, he served as Director of Gulf Affairs at the National Security Council, where he was the principal working-level official responsible for implementing U.S. policy toward Iran. Before his time in the Clinton administration, he spent 7 years in the CIA as a Persian Gulf military analyst. He is author of a new book that's titled The Persian Puzzle, The Conflict Between Iran and America. It's published by Random House. It's out now. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have a couple of people here. We'll start in with a caller in Champaign, line one.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, I have a couple of axes of questions. The first one has to do with what you were talking about, this anti-Americanism, which is part of the ideology of Khomeini, or the U.S. as Satan, and then the response on both sides, perhaps, to that ideology, which is the clash of civilizations, and how that works in with what President Khatami was talking about in the 90s about a dialogue of civilizations. Are you saying that this Axis of Evil statement kind of acted to squelch any kind of talk about a dialogue of civilizations?
certainly the axis of evil didn't help things. And I think from Iran's perspective, it really did put a damper on the possibility of greater cooperation between the two societies. That said, I don't think that you can put all of the blame on the Bush administration. There were other forces at work too. First, within Iran, President Khatami had largely been emasculated even by the time of the axis of evil speech. President Khatami started out like a fireball, and unfortunately he fizzled. And by, I'd say, the summer of 1999, it was clear that the hardliners in Iran had effectively undercut the reform movement. And today, if you speak to Iranians, they will tell you that the reform movement in Iran that Mohammad Khatami led is effectively dead, and no one expects that it will be able to be revived for another 5 or 10 years. So Iran's own internal politics also helped squelch that effort at bridging the differences between the two sides. And then beyond that, in the Bush administration's defense, and I think you have to be balanced in thinking about the problems on both sides here, the Iranians were also up to a whole bunch of stuff that I think that most Americans would and did find highly objectionable. There was the provision of arms to the Palestinian Authority for terrorist attacks against Israel, the Karin A, that huge ship that the Israelis intercepted. There was a series of attacks in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia in May 2003, which the United States was able to intercept communications. These were al-Qaeda attacks that were launched by people in communication, basically directed by al-Qaeda leaders in, of all places, Iran. And Iran had traditionally hated al-Qaeda, had helped us fight against al-Qaeda and the Taliban. But now here, all of a sudden, they were turning around and allowing al-Qaeda leaders to operate from Iran and to coordinate attacks against Americans in Saudi Arabia from Iran. And then beyond that,
that's
in 2003.
Right, later than the Iraq war and the Axis of Evil speech, but I just wanted to point that out.
Well, the Axis of Evil speech, of course, is January 2002, and the Iraq War was just April of 2003. Mm-hmm. So all of these things happen fairly simultaneously. Yeah, from the Iranian perspective, the first problem is the Axis of Evil speech. But add to that the fact that you did have this activity going on the Iranian side, it helped squelch all of this.
Mm-hmm. My second set of questions has to do with and maybe you won't feel that you're prepared to talk about this, but there's this news about the UN talking about having major changes to the way it's set up and becoming more interventionist. At least that's the buzzword I hear on the BBC. I haven't read about it in detail. And I'm just wondering, we've been hearing about these talks with Europe and Iran and how maybe that Iran is playing Europe against the U.S. or something to that effect. I'm just wondering, it seems to me that the U.S. has tremendous control over what happens in the U.N. to begin with. Are these changes in the U.N. only going to kind of just give more power to the U.S. and more power to, the Bush administration if they take place during the Bush administration's term? It seems to me that they're just going to be an arm of the war on terror as the Bush administration sees it, which includes the invasion of Iraq, for example.
I certainly think that would be the preference of the Bush administration, and obviously that is the direction of many of the changes that they're talking about. There are other people talking about very different kinds of changes, changes that would make the United Nations in some cases more accountable, in some cases more useful. I think that could take the United Nations in very different directions that wouldn't necessarily suit the interests of the more activist and interventionist members of the Bush administration.
But which way is it likely to pan out?
I'm sorry?
Which way is it likely to pan out?
I think it's very unclear at the moment. And my guess is it's going to take a long time to make any of this happen, because the fact of the matter is that these kind of changes to the UN, some of the changes that people are talking about are so far-reaching, expanding the Security Council, bringing in additional permanent members. These kind of changes are so far-reaching that I think that we have to think about them not happening for quite time. And I wouldn't want to speculate on exactly which way they're going to pan out over that kind of a length of time. I will say, though, that I actually think that what's going on now between the IAEA and Europe and Iran is actually a very positive set of developments. Believe me, it's not a solution to Iran's development of nuclear weapons, but I think that it could be the beginning of a solution. And I would very much like to see the United States involved in those talks, not simply standing on the outside criticizing, because I think that this is one of those problems where this kind of a multilateral approach is probably our only hope of solving the problem.
Can you talk more about that? And I'll hang up. Thanks a lot.
Sure. The problem that we have with Iran is that there aren't any easy answers to the problem of Iran's desire to develop nuclear weapons. Iranians are fiercely nationalistic. They are deeply concerned about the United States because they believe that we have a history of intervening in their country, and they're not entirely wrong about that. They do feel threatened by the United States. Iranians also have a tremendous sense of their own importance. They want nuclear weapons because they think that their country ought to be one of the great powers of the world, and they see membership in the nuclear club as bringing that kind of interest. So there are some powerful incentives in Iran to acquire the nuclear weapons. And I think that what we learned during the 1990s was that neither the policy that the United States took nor that Europe took was particularly successful. The U.S. policy in the 1990s was pure sticks, just hit the Iranians and hit them harder every time they did something that we didn't like and hope that this would change their behavior. The Europeans, on the other hand, had a policy of all carrots, just reward.
We have lost our connection with the guest there. Hopefully we can reestablish that in just a moment. We do have another caller holding. We'll try to get on to some other people and get them into the conversation. Maybe I'll just take this opportunity again to reintroduce the guests for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Ken Pollack from the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., where he is director of research at the Sabin Center for Middle East Policy at Brookings. Has been following events in the Middle East for quite a long time, particularly Iran. He served on the National Security Council. This was during the Clinton administration. Before that, he spent 7 years in the CIA as a Persian Gulf military analyst. And he has a new book out that looks at the difficult relationship between Iran and the United States, going back certainly to the Iran hostage crisis and really even further back than that, back to the coup that took place in 1953 that we talked about at the beginning of our conversation. Ken Pollack's book is titled The Persian Puzzle, The Conflict Between Iran and America. And once again, this book is published by Random House. It's out now in the bookstore if you would like to take a look at it. Also, of course, if you're interested in Brookings and in seeing some of the other things that Mr. Pollack has written, he and other people who are attached to Brookings are there available on the Brookings Institution website. And there, if you'll go to the page where you'll find out about him, there are a number of publications that you might like to take a look at. Some of his comments, not just on Iran, but also on the Iraq War, on terrorism, on Middle East policy more generally. And if you're interested, you can look at the website, which is www.brookings.edu. And I think we have him back. Mr. Pollack, we got you back now? Well, we're still working on it. We have these high-quality connections that we sometimes can use between Washington, D.C. and here and other places that have them. And it almost makes it sound like the person is in the studio with us, but he's not. He is in Washington this morning. What we might have to do is simply get on the telephone and do the second half of the show by telephone. Our apologies. Once in a while, technical things go wrong, and sometimes it's not within our control. At any rate, in just a moment here, we will set up our connection again, and we'll get back to our conversation with Ken Pollack. Questions are welcome. We do have one caller who is ready to go, and again, if that person will just be patient and hang in there, we can talk with him, and then we'd be happy to take some other calls as well. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455, and we do also have that toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. Mr. Pollack?
David, can you Can you hear me now?
Yes,
am I
sir.
Back?
Yes, I'm very sorry. I'm not sure how that happened. As I was explaining to people here, we have these this ability to make this connection.
Right.
That sounds as if we're in the same room together, but we're not. He is in Washington, D.C. I am here in Urbana. We'll cross our fingers and hope that we'll be square here for the rest of the show.
Keep the gremlins off the line.
Exactly. I guess what you were talking about Iran's nuclear ambitions, and this has, of course, been a point of tension between Iran and the United States. The Iranians say that they're interested in developing nuclear power. The United States is concerned about the possibility of nuclear weapons. And I guess that, one thing that we know is that a state that has the means and is determined to develop nuclear weapons, it's kind of difficult to stop them. Might it be that we might indeed have to say, at least for a while, that we would just live with it? We would say that, all right, if Iran wanted to develop nuclear weapons and would have a few, that's something that we could deal with. And again, we would hope that that they would never be used, but that we would say we continue to have some negotiations and we wouldn't have some sort of extreme position that says, well, as long as you have these things, we're not going to talk to you. I mean, what do we do?
Well, from my own perspective, I think what you're suggesting at the end of the day may be what we have to do. And I will say that as far as I'm concerned, I think it is possible for the United States to live with a nuclear Iran. Iran is not like Saddam Hussein's Iraq. They're not like North Korea. This is a regime that is aggressive. It is anti-American. It is anti a lot of things that we stand for. And it will be very problematic if they have nuclear weapons. But they are not reckless. They're not crazy. They have shown a pragmatism and a prudence in their decision making, which suggests that at the end of the day, if we had to do so, we probably could handle Iran through deterrence the way that we deterred the Soviet Union. That said, I'd really prefer not to have to live in a world where Iran has nuclear weapons. And I think that there actually are, at this point in time, still some reasonable options open to us, diplomatic options, economic options that are still available to us that could allow us to dissuade Iran from moving down this course. It's why I would very much like to see the United States get involved with the Europeans in their current effort to broker a deal with the Iranians. While I think that the deal that the Europeans have so far arranged has a lot of problems with it, I think that it is one that could be made much better. And if we could make it much better and persuade the Iranians to buy into it, I think it would be a much better way to deal with their problem than either some kind of a military option, which I think in the case of Iran would just be a terrible idea at this point in time, or simply allowing them to, you know, go ahead and say, if you want them, you can have them, which, as I said, I think we could live with, but I'd rather not.
All right. Well, let's talk with someone in Indiana this morning on our toll-free line 4. Hello.
Hello. I want to take this opportunity to speak to somebody, in a sense, has policies that are actually considered by people who are in power. So it's going to be nebulous. I'm just going to let you do it the way you want to. But I want you to tie it in with a statement you just made a short time ago that I do not want Iran to have nuclear weapons. So what I want is sort of a broad brushstroke of the Middle East in terms of sort of the logic of the mistakes you think this administration and maybe previous ones have made with Iran and that whole conglomerate. And the first thing that came to my mind when you said that I do not want Iran to have nuclear weapons, it came to my mind that some young student who's contemplating, which way he's going to go, that I don't want a Christian nation to be the only one that has nuclear weapons, in terms especially how one of those Christian nations is operating right now in my back door. Thanks.
All right. Well, you can deal with that however you like.
Sure. It raises a set of, I think, some fairly important questions, and let me see if I can take it in that broad brush sense that the viewer requested. From Iran's perspective, I think that it's not hard to see why they would want nuclear weapons. They consider themselves the descendants of an ancient civilization, very rightfully so. They believe that they ought to be one of the great powers of the world, and they know that nuclear weapons confer prestige, which nothing else can. Beyond that, as they see it, they've been attacked by the United States a number of times over the past 50 years. In some cases, they were it was unprovoked. In some cases, they actually provoked us. But the Iranian perspective is always that the United States is its implacable foe. And given the fact that this administration in particular has just invaded Afghanistan, their neighbor to the east, Iraq, their neighbor to the west, and labeled them one of three countries in an axis of evil, again, I don't think it's hard if any of us were Iranians to understand why they might want a nuclear weapon to deter an American specifically attack. That said, we also do have real problems with the Iranians. And, you know, looking at the region as a whole, there are a lot of people in the Middle East who are very, very uncomfortable with the Iranians. This is a regime which for 25 years has set itself up as being the champion of the anti-status quo movement. They have tried to overthrow governments in Saudi Arabia, in Kuwait, in Bahrain. They've mounted terrorist attacks, certainly on Israel and the United States, but arguably also against Egypt and other Arab countries in the region. They are one of the largest state sponsors of terrorism, probably the leading state sponsor of the terrorism in the world now that Afghanistan, that the Taliban regime has been taken down. And they can be a rather aggressive and also often very insensitive country. They occupied several islands that the UAE claims and then turned around and offered to forgive the UAE for objecting if the UAE would just come to its senses. And it's things like that that really don't make too many of Iran's neighbors feel very comfortable with it. So there are real problems out there with Iran. And of course, one of the things that we have to fear is that, like Pakistan, for example, which wanted nuclear weapons for purely defensive reasons to deter India, once Pakistan acquired nuclear weapons, they suddenly felt like the Indians couldn't do anything to them, that India couldn't retaliate either in a nuclear conventional sense. And that led very quickly to their very aggressive terrorist operations and ultimately the Kargil crisis, which threatened a nuclear war between India and Pakistan. And there's a fear that Iran could move in the same direction, that though they want the nuclear weapons for defensive purposes, once they've got them, they might see them as basically immunizing them from an American response and therefore enable some form of aggression. So I think all of that creates a very complicated perspective. And the trick for the United States in particular is to figure out ways to reassure the Iranians about their own security and also convince them that acquiring nuclear weapons ultimately will be more detrimental for them than helpful to them. There is a real debate inside of Iran, and it's one thing that I hear most often missing from the Washington policy debate over how to handle Iran. There's a sense in Washington that every Iranian wants nuclear weapons, and that's true, but only insofar as it goes. Iranians want nuclear weapons, but when you ask Iranians a different question, which is, how much do you want nuclear weapons, and do you want nuclear weapons more than, say, democracy or more than, say, a stable, thriving economy, you get very different answers. Most Iranians are most concerned about their economic situation. And I think that the United States has an opportunity working with our European allies to convince Iran that its economy will thrive if it agrees to give up these weapons. It will suffer if it decides to continue down this path. And I think that would be an extraordinarily powerful set of incentives for Iran in its internal thinking.
We have about 15 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Ken Pollack. He is Director of Research at the Sabin Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. It is author of a newly published book that looks at the relationship between Iran and America. The title is The Persian Puzzle, and is published by Random House. We have some other callers here. We'll go next to someone in Gibson City. This is line 3.
Yes, hello.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I guess I have kind of a question comment. We are the superpower, the United States, and I guess shouldn't we be setting the example? Because I think we have the weapons of mass, the highest record of weapons of mass destruction. I think the numbers, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but our weapons of mass destruction are much more than any other country, maybe several countries put together. I guess maybe we should take the log out of our own eye, and before we start trying to take the log out of somebody else's eye. And I think that other countries looking at us are afraid of us because of all of our weapons of mass destruction. And I know it would probably be a long process, but I do think there'd be a way of, I guess I wonder what your idea would be, a way of have an international court or whatever – of the United States being the leader in getting rid of weapons of mass destruction and starting with themselves. And I'll hang up and listen to what your ideas are. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very important issue out there because, in point of fact, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which of course is the legal document that we use to try to keep other countries from acquiring nuclear weapons, the Iranians signed the NPT, so they have pledged themselves not to acquire nuclear weapons, and we try to turn around and hold them to that. But what I think most people don't realize is that the NPT also commits the nuclear states to get rid of their arsenal of nuclear weapons. And as the caller is pointing out, the United States has a massive nuclear arsenal. Now, we have significantly scaled it back since the end of the Cold War, but the simple fact of the matter is we still have several thousand nuclear weapons. And I certainly think that it would be helpful to the United States if we would be willing to further reduce our nuclear arsenal so that we could say to other people, and especially those states that are thinking about getting nuclear weapons themselves, we are honoring our obligations under the NPT. And we are trying to move in this direction. So I certainly think that would be helpful. That said, that's not going to be enough by itself to convince the Iranians to give up their nuclear weapons program. As I said before, they've got some very compelling reasons from their own perspective why they want nuclear weapons, and just having the U.S. move down this track ain't going to be enough for them. For that reason, I think that one of the other tax that the United States need to take, one of the other assets that we need to employ in trying to convince the Iranians that it's just more cost than benefit in acquiring nuclear weapons, is to engage in a program of dialogue and ultimately arms control with the Iranians. I think that if we were to hold out to them the prospect of a process in the Persian Gulf, similar to like what we did with the Russians in Europe at the end of the Cold War, that too might be very enticing for a number of Iranians. Remember, you know, we had no love for the Soviet Union. We were deeply distrustful of them. At best, Ronald Reagan said we should trust but verify. But at the end of the Cold War, we worked out a set of arms control agreements with the Soviet Union that did a great deal of good in terms of moving both of us to a much more stable relationship, diminishing the distrust, increasing our own sense of security. And one of the things that we don't have now in the Persian Gulf is anything similar to that. But I think if we had something similar where Iranians could come, air their grievances, hear what we had to say, work out confidence-building measures, and maybe even the final step, agree to kind of mutual and balanced force reductions in the Persian Gulf, that might diminish a lot of the security incentives that Iranians have for wanting nuclear weapons. It's not a full solution, but I think it could be part of a solution.
One thing before we find ourselves out of time, I want to raise, given the fact that the Iranians see the United States as being a power that has meddled in their affairs for at least half century now, we have to be very careful about how it is we go in Iran. At the same time, though, is it possible to find people in Iran that we could talk to, that would be willing to talk with us, that might be a little bit more moderate, a little bit more reform-minded than the hardliners in the government, and to do that without also making it look like we're in a ham-handed fashion trying to influence Iranian politics?
You had me right up until that last point. And that unfortunately is the rub, is the fact that we can always find Iranians who want to talk to the United States. We can always find Iranians who are moderate, reasonable, want better relations with the United States, understand our concerns, and want to help us to reach compromises. The problem that we have seen with Iran time and time again is that those people rarely are in positions of power and ability to actually control the Iranian government. And because the United States remains this incredibly difficult emotional and political issue inside Iranian politics, whenever these kind of conversations get exposed, they invariably hurt the people having them. It's one of the tragedies of U.S.-Iranian relations, which is that over the past 25 years, every time the U.S. has tried to reach out to a group inside of Iran and find some way to help them, typically we've only wound up hurting them.
We have some other callers here. Let's talk with someone else. Champaign County, line 2. Hello.
Hi. I'm very pleased to hear you mentioning the NPT and the fact that it has other implications. When states sign on to it, they're accepting their own obligation, but they're accepting obligation by the superpowers to do something to ratchet down entirely. The settlement to whatever we can call the end of the Gulf War I includes language about trying to work towards demilitarizing the region, least ratcheting it down.
Right.
So we have that as well, even more recently. What prompted me to call, though, was to ask about the constituency for attacking Iran and for Bush putting it in the axis of evil. I believe when you were in the Clinton administration, the bombing of the apartment building where the servicemen were killed, the Saudis were trying to blame that not on their own constituency, but from some outside Iranians. And I guess according to Clark's book, there was a move to attack Iran then, and that's when you would have been in, I believe, in the discussions. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious what would you say about how that was? I mean, maybe some people actually did believe the Saudis, but there was no reason to believe that they were not trying to fool themselves as well as other people about where the opposition to their rule was coming from. It wasn't from there. Anyway, I don't know what you're going to be comfortable to say about that internal discussion. Sure. Where is the constituency? Is it just the neocons? It's not coming out of the Pentagon, I don't think, is it?
Sure. It's a great and very informed question. I will say, because I know we're running out of time, I have actually a fairly extensive section in the book that talks exactly about this. The caller is absolutely right. When the bombing at Khobar Towers took place in 1996, it was kind of unclear exactly who was responsible. And it is true that the Saudis initially immediately blamed Iran. Now, the strange part of the story is it actually has turned out that it was Iran. And in fact, there was an indictment handed down in U.S. federal court a couple of years ago, because we now have extensive evidence that documents the Iranian involvement in it. But as the caller is suggesting, at the time, the information was unclear. And, you know, to give you kind of the punchline, and I hope others will actually read the entire part of that book, part of my book that talks about this and get some of the nuances. But my bottom line was, while I think it would have been good for the United States to retaliate militarily against Iran at that time for what was a clear attack on the United States, because I think that it was important to send that deterrent signal to Iran, the fact of the matter is we didn't have the information. And, you know, my own experience with the invasion of Iraq and the fact that we got it wrong on the weapons of mass destruction, I think really needs to serve as a cautionary note that sometimes even when we think we have great intelligence, we don't. And you don't want to do something like mount a retaliatory strike if you're not pretty certain about what you're about to do. I mean, imagine if we had gone ahead and bombed Iran and killed a number of Iranians, and then lo and behold, it turned out they weren't responsible for Khobar Towers. Now, again, as I said, we've got quite good evidence on this now, but we didn't at the time.
And as far as... If I might ask, where can I find that on the web? Because you can indict a ham sandwich, as the famous expression.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, you should pull up the indictment. I would do a Google search under Khobar Towers, Iranian, Lebanese, a couple of names like that. I've actually got, if you go grab a copy of my book, I've got in the footnotes the actual website where you can find the indictment. But this was something where it took us 7 years, I guess, with the Saudis, working with the Saudis, because the Saudis did eventually, by about 1999, 2000, come up with very good evidence showing the Iranian hand behind Khobar Towers. But it wasn't until 1999, 2000, when Khatami was president in Iran again. And just to answer your final point about today, you're absolutely right that there is a drumbeat saying we ought to attack Iran. It actually is, as best I can tell, coming from the Office of the Secretary of Defense in the Pentagon. That doesn't mean Rumsfeld himself. That means the people who work around Rumsfeld. There is a constituency there that is saying that, you know, Iran needs to be next on the list. I will tell you that my sense is that most senior administration officials kind of like the idea of regime change in Iran, but they seem to recognize that our military options in Iran are really quite poor, at least at the moment.
Well, it seems to me that... you talked about the polls that show how pro-American the population is. There's always been this problem with, exacerbating the situation. And maybe this is an argument for letting the Europeans actually handle most of the negotiations, since they're less colonially, except for Britain, implicated in the situation. And But I don't think the people at the Pentagon, neocon or otherwise, and the White House are particularly comfortable with, you know, assigning that kind of power to any other independent actor. And I know there's no time. Thanks.
Well, I think it's certainly correct that it doesn't seem like the Bush administration is interested in allowing the Europeans to take the lead in a process that would include the United States. I would simply say, though, that I think actually it's critical that the United States join in this process. The Iranians don't regard the Europeans as credible in many ways because, in all honesty, the Europeans made some threats throughout the 1990s and never followed through on them. So most Iranians think that they can get away with murder with the Europeans. And I think it will require the United States to be on board to make it clear that, no, this time it's all going to stick. I also think that at the end of the day, you know, the Europeans have given just about all the carrots that they can. The country that needs to give on the carrot side is the United States. And I think that the way that we're going to get the Europeans, the only way that we might get the Europeans to agree to sticks if Iran doesn't cooperate, is to agree that we will provide carrots if Iran does cooperate.
One further question. Unfortunately, I can only give you about a minute. I'm interested in having you talk for a minute or a minute and a half about what are Iran's interests in Iraq?
Sure. Again, a hopelessly complicated question.
I understand.
I talk about a lot in the book. Basic point is this. Iran has many interests in Iraq. Right now, its preeminent interest is stability. The Iranians are terrified of chaos in Iraq. And while they don't want a U.S.-dominated Iraq, an Iraq that they think could serve as a springboard for an invasion of Iran, they're even more concerned that we will fail in Iraq or we will simply walk away and turn Iraq into Lebanon as it was in the 1970s and 80s. They saw how Lebanon destabilized Syria, destabilized Israel. They don't want to be living next to a state like that. And as a result, you've had this kind of weird, again, tacit cooperation between the United States and Iran. Unfortunately, you're seeing a lot of press stories that are blaming Iran, I actually think very unfairly. The Iranians are in there mucking around in their own way, but in fact, they've actually been much more cooperative than they have been confrontational when it comes to Iraq.
Well, at that, I think that we will have to stop as we have used our time. For people who want to read more on the subject, again, I would suggest you look at the book we've talked about. It's titled The Persian Puzzle, The Conflict Between Iran and America. It's published by Random House by our guest, Ken Pollack. He is director of research at the Sabin Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. And Mr. Pollack, we want to thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been my pleasure.
And also thanks to the folks there at Brookings on their end of the connection. Also, if you're interested in finding out more about the Brookings Institution, they have many different scholars interested in different issues, both domestic and international. And if you have internet access, you may simply go to their website, which is www.brookings.edu.